This summarizes models from various places around the world, characterizing the shear velocity structure. P velocity structure tends to be more difficult to resolve for various reasons I could go into, technical reasons. But there are limited patches that we have good coverage of. We're never going to be able to do the global models. And I think it's frustrating, but it's the reality. We cannot hope to get this type of resolution globally, so we have to live with where we can do this. But we can sample places out in the middle of the Pacific and in the Circumpacific high region, or this faster area under Eurasia that Adam pointed out. And general attributes to the structure, there's a couple hundred kilometer thick layer that appears to have some discreteness to it in terms of this abrupt velocity increase at the top, which ranges from 0.5% to up to 3%, and seems to show a lot of variability in both increase and in depth. Now, we're going to hear later about some of the evidence, I hope, for post-perovskite phase change. It's a possible explanation of such a structure. This could be the top of a chemically distinct layer or mounds, not laterally continuous perhaps, or with a lot of topography on them. It could also be the result of a phase change. This has been speculated by seismologists for some time, but now we actually have some evidence that a phase change happens somewhere in the vicinity of the core mantle boundary, likely, though it may be down in the core, from what I heard yesterday. For the ultra-low velocity zones, the scales are very different. Now we're looking at a 20 kilometer thickness here. This thickness is small, but the velocity reductions are huge. These are on full scale, so 10% up to 30% shear velocity reductions illustrated here. And with 10% or so density increases, and I'll show some evidence that we can actually tell that the density does increase in some of these patches. As people, maybe Bruce Buffett spoke about it last week or before, that advocates some structure at the outermost outer core. And this presumably could be happening if there's some sort of topographic high or within the gravitational field, some region where you can stabilize light material and create some finite rigidity in the outer core. But I won't speak much to that because I think the verdict is really still out. Basic attributes of these ULVZs, we can't probably resolve a half kilometer, but we might be able to resolve 2 kilometer thickness up to 10 kilometers where you have 10 to 30% velocity reductions. Now the big effort has been to try and determine what is the P velocity reduction relative to S as a diagnostic of whether this is a chemical effect of strong iron enrichment or a partial melting effect. And I think the verdict is still out, but we see the ratio of P to S being about 2.5 to 3, which is in that range between what you can do chemically and what you can do with partial melt, and get ratios 2.7 to 3 by partial melting. And so people tend to believe this is evidence for partial melting, the density increase giving you evidence for iron fractionation into the melt and stabilizing right at the base of the mantle. Here's a map of where ULVZs are seen from a recent study by Thorne and Garnero, that's not me. The bright red areas in this map are areas where they believe there's a good likelihood that ULVZ exists. And you can see they actually have better coverage than we've been able to obtain by looking at topside reflections, because this involves using different waveforms that sample more extensively the structure. Big areas in the South Pacific, I don't believe that one, but they argue that they're a big patch under the Gulf of Mexico, under Northern Eurasia, under India. They're not easily correlated with where we see faster, slow velocity material in kind of the 200 kilometer thickness or the base of the mantle. And this is pretty robust. They can get thicknesses on the order of 10 kilometers. The yellow stuff is 8 kilometers or so, where they observe these features.
I guess in Africa, you show their zero likelihood, but then you determine the thickness of it.
Yeah. I didn't. That's what I said.
The other Thorn.
Other Thorn. The last name Thorn. All we need is a Thorn. I think not. I don't want to try and defend this work. It's not my work. But I would say that there is convincing evidence that in some regions, like the South Pacific, you observe it over a very extensive region. You see many, many observations that are consistent with this ULBZ. Now, the way you model that influences how you would make such a map. These maps are based on 1D type of interpretations, which I think exaggerate the sampling region, the Fresnel zone.
But you got zero coverage for a lot of that region.
Don't say you. That's not different thorn. That's not my favorite. But there have been detailed waveform studies that show that you can do stuff on a 100-kilometer scale, which locally make a 3D little blob that if you interpret it as a 1D, you would spread over 1,000 kilometers by Fresnel zone. So I think these grossly exaggerate the spatial area of ULBZ. But it's not my work. I'm just showing you the... These guys, which I don't really want to talk about, this is the core rigidity zone. So this is their effort to find regions where you, if you map the same data, you can put stuff on the mantle of the core side and you can map it into one or the other.
Just one question about this deep evaporation. When you say, or they say, every thickness in principle, I think you may fix the thickness and vary the melt factor. Right? Because we'll get a map of the melt pressure. For example, not actually the melt thickness, they just assume maybe some particular amplitude, maybe,
of variation. There is coupling in this, in that if you change the velocity, you can change the thickness to a certain extent. It's not an absolute trade-off. In this particular case, they may be specifying, I don't know the details, this paper is in press, I haven't seen it. They may be specifying the magnitude of the anomaly just to do a reconnaissance. But they are mapping variation in thickness based on travel time fluctuation then. So you could probably play off with the, because you see these phases moving relative to one another, and you'd see their thickness or velocity. So you're right, there's a lot of trade-offs. But these are strong effects. The waveform effects are very big, so you can believe that there's something going on. It is non-trivial to interpret it. Finally, there's these large, low-velocity provinces. This is the one under southern Atlantic, southern Africa, southern Indian Ocean. And this is showing Wen's model of it, which is a very kind of flattened model relative to what Helmberg was showing. That stuff going up much higher. But these are huge areas where the velocities, shear velocities, are on the order of average of 3 to 5% slow. And as you can see in this illustration, they have very steep sides. And one of the robust aspects of these is that they entail very strong lateral gradients in structure. And that is hard to explain away. I mean, it's very difficult. They do have to have very strong lateral gradients. Now, these are big volumes of material. Excuse me. This one has a thickness of 300 kilometers in Wen's model. In Helmberger's models, these regions over in the Indian Ocean, he's extrapolating up 1,000 kilometers. And we would agree that Wen has not tried to image the mid-mantle component of this. So he may have, you know, these velocity anomalies go down as low as 12%, the reddest part here. He may have squeezed stuff into a smaller area and gotten stronger anomalies, and you could spread it out and have weaker anomalies. They look very steep because they're very steep.
But there is a factor of 10 vertical exaggeration in the way it's plotted there.
No question, but they're very steep relative to what we might have anticipated. These are 3 or 4% variations over 100 kilometer scalings. Okay. And you know, I guess the prevailing notion I would have had, the bias I would have, is that, well, right in the vicinity of this huge density contrast, so it's going to flatten out, it's going to be swept around. Here you've got to have dynamical processes or intrinsic viscosity contrasts that can sustain steep-walled sides to stuff that is chemically anomalous. This stuff has no p-velocity anomaly. P-velocity through this showed no perturbation.
Well, I wouldn't quite say so, because we detect the great African plume also in p-velocities.
Very, very weak. You're talking about 0.25%. There's very little. I'll show you data which show no P anomaly, where the S anomalies are very big.
Because it seems like this very high 12% thing is just on the wall of it, and the interior of it seems to be...
No, these are laterally uniform within the structure. These are modeled as a gradient, which has a small reduction at the top and a strong decrease. But it's a 1D model within that structure in lens modeling.
But it's a very strong anomaly. I don't know, maybe it's shading or something. But say on this the C figure, the side that's sort of south of Africa.
South of Africa, right here.
It seems all dark, so like minus 12%.
Oh, no, that's yellow up here. It's grading. I don't know. Maybe the projector's not capturing it. It's locally a one-dimensional grading.
Well, we've been modeling this anomaly using the spectroelement method, and in fact, what we can show is that it's really sharp because not only is the transition rapid, so scan attention within the animal, but it's also actually detecting the depth that is vertical.
No, I don't think so. I think Helmberger's models would have this all being constant 3%. Okay. Instead, this gradient here would give you an average of 5 or 6%. So that's why I say 3 to 5. The details aren't resolved, but this structure has steep sides, it's low shear velocity, there may be some reduction in P velocity, but it's not anywhere in proportion.
Maybe you're about to carry it, but this is like...
This isn't even capped at 1,000. This is capped at 300. But Helmberger's models, I'll show, will kind of extrapolate upward. But you'll see that the tomography doesn't show as strong of an anomaly. All right. One last attribute that you get from detailed studies is characterizing anisotropy. These are regions of the base canal studied by kind of detailed waveform analysis of broadband seismic data. And again, it's limited coverage. And you could do something globally, but not with this kind of quality data. And the different colors, this is a big low velocity area. There's anisotropy observed here. There's anisotropy in these blue high velocity areas. And it's summarized over here on the right, where as a function of distance from 80 degrees out into the core shadow zone, we measure the difference in arrival time of waves that have traveled through as shear waves moving the ground up and down versus shear waves moving the ground horizontally in the D double prime region. And what you tend to see is most of the data having S that moves up and down arrive a little bit after, a few seconds typically, after S that moves the ground horizontally. It's a birefringent effect, a shear wave splitting effect caused by structure or mineralogical fabrics that allows the horizontally shearing stress waves to propagate a little bit faster through this medium than waves that are shaking the ground up and down. That's what the data tell us, and it's pretty systematic, and it's pretty uniform in these blue areas. Within this region, and I'll show you within this region now, in fact, it's not that simple. The northeastern portion of this work that Barbara's worked extensively on, you do have this horizontal motion being faster than the SV, but toward the southwestern part of that, the opposite occurs, and the vertically polarized polarization moves through the medium faster than the horizontally polarized polarization. It's only a few percent, on the order of 2% maximum on these larger scale. Maybe locally it could be up to 5 or 6%, but on average it's not that strong. And it's a fairly subtle signal, so it was only kind of systematically mapped in the last 15 years. Okay. Well, let me begin to summarize these observations in the context of this cartoon, which summarizes the large-scale tomography, mid-Pacific low-velocity, sub-African low-velocity provinces, high velocity in one of the circum-Pacific areas. I take that just to be under the Americas. Large-scale patterns dominate. Kind of a degree two type pattern predominates, with probably strength of plus or minus 3%. Now in these, the regional studies sort of highlight attributes of this. These low velocity areas tend to have ultra low velocity zones, though they're not ubiquitous within these areas, and you do find high velocity areas with low velocity, ultra low velocity zones. They have anisotropy in them, but tends to be azimuthal anisotropy that has not been well constrained. And these regions tend to have strong scattering right at the core mantle boundary, which I haven't spoken about, but is presumably coupled to the presence of the very strong velocity fluctuations in the ULVZ. These higher velocity regions tend to have the better established velocity increases, a couple hundred kilometers above the core mantle boundary. And they tend to have this radial isotropy where the SH component tends to be faster than the SV. You have these big superplume provinces where primarily the anomaly is in S, very steep sides. They're very large, low velocity regions, and they may extend in some places up 1,000 kilometers or more. Intervening regions between these are less studied. They're somewhat less accessible for detailed study, but I'll show an example where there's actually no anisotropy right under the Atlantic. So I'm going to have to abbreviate this, but I'm going to go through some case studies for each of those regions, just picking the most recent results to single out some attribute of one characteristic or another of these areas. First, I'm going to talk about this high velocity region under the Caribbean. These are cross sections and tomographic models. They all show right at the base of the mantle in this area, high velocity, several percent high in shear velocity. The mid-mantle has high velocities as well, and these are the Farallon slabs sinking to the base of the mantle in people's interpretations. And these are somewhat truncated spherical harmonic presentations, but nonetheless, the mid-mantle is high velocity. Now in these areas, what we observe is there's strong velocity heterogeneity, strong D double prime discontinuities, and strong anisotropy. The information for layering for D double prime discontinuities comes from waveforms that have an arrival, this middle arrival, which shouldn't be there if there was no velocity discontinuity at the base of the mantle. In broadband data, you can see these sharp arrivals that requires strong velocity gradients. They'll be between the S arrival and SCS, which turn in the mid-mantle or reflect off the core, respectively. Now, the presence of that waveform complexity allows you to detect the velocity increase, and we're now utilizing the detections and the travel time fluctuations of those in full 3D tomography by the kind of Princeton methodologies, which were somewhat poo-pooed, but it's not because the methodology is bad, it's just not clear that it's worth all the work. I tend to agree, but nonetheless, this is what you do to get published now in seismology. Here, though, we're able to introduce into tomography a phase that isn't normally used in tomography. It's one that reflects from the top of D double prime, so it gives us much better vertical coverage of the deep mantle than we would have by the integral coverage of just SCS going through. And these little color plots show how a wave samples the Earth as it sweeps down through the D double prime region and is observed. And in particular, this kernel here is for a differential time between reflection off the top of this discontinuity and the reflection off the core. And we put the velocity heterogeneity into the tomographic model based on how sensitive that particular differential time is to the Earth based on this 3D theory. And it does pretty well. And these models, I'm not going to compare them with the ray-based inversions, but what we're able to do is do tomographic models over regional scales, as shown here. And these are cross sections over the bottom 500 kilometers of a model, where we've added in all the data for SKS, SCS, S waves, and these reflections off of the top of D double prime to try and improve on the regional scale what we can do with global tomography. And it is interesting what you find. Don't look at the whole plot, just look at the center of these plots, which are the well resolved areas. And there's a big blue area under the Gulf of Mexico that extends up 500 kilometers above the core mantle boundary. And it's actually contiguous with these features that are imaged by Steve Grand and his models. So I think there are velocity heterogeneities pretty much vertically through the lowermost mantle. And those penetrate down into a very high velocity area. You can see the whole background goes blue. That's the presence of the discontinuity 250 kilometers above the core. And there's little patches of low velocity material that look like columns penetrating through the D double prime region on scale lengths of a couple hundred kilometers that we can resolve with this purportedly high resolution sophisticated tomography. And I'm not a keen enthusiast on tomography, but these are interesting models. And it seems to me that what we're seeing is strong lateral gradients from a region with a strong discontinuity under the Gulf of Mexico to a region with less of a discontinuity under northern South Africa. And possibly little plume-like structures within the boundary layer on the margin of where high-velocity material extends continuously through the bottom 500 kilometers. Now, if you're a Mike Gernis-type dynamicist, you might think there's a downwelling sinking through the mantle, displacing hot boundary layer material that goes unstable, comes little plumes on the margins of it. And he and Tan have explored that type of model in a G-cube paper. Now we can do a lot of additional things with the presence of this third arrival. Here's S and SCS, the conventional seismic arrival. There's a big, you know, some people pretend this isn't there, but it's actually pretty big in between the two. And we can enhance it by removing source processes as illustrated here, and then by stacking signals using various array processing techniques. This is something that's not been that vigorously applied in seismology, except in the last 10 years or going back in the 60s and 70s when there were a lot of seismic arrays. There's a lot of power in these methods, allowing you to find S and SCS with good resolution in terms of timing and slowness, inverse velocity on the surface, and to detect this intermediate arrival. It's very clear that such a feature exists, and we can map out its timing and direction systematically because there's now so much seismic data available that we're kind of overwhelmed by it, and we're going to be flooded by new data from Earthscope. So you actually can see these arrivals in lots of seismograms. You can stack them up and image the structure in greater detail than we were able to do even 5 years ago. Example of a detailed stacking study shown here, looking under a place under the Cocos Plate. A lot of data, deep earthquakes recorded at the densest North American distribution of seismic stations, which is the Berkeley and the Caltech Trinet networks in California. And now for a given event, we'll get 100 recordings. We can stack up lots and lots of seismograms. If we do that, we can detect structure on scales that we haven't been able to do before. But shown over here on the right, just look at this plot. This is height above the core mantle boundary, 0 up to 400 kilometers. At the core mantle boundary, we find SCS, strong reflection. Above it, we find kind of this spread of energy, which is different than what we find for the PREM model. That's not a single arrival. So what we believe is that this is energy coming back from the top of the D double prime. But if we stack all these data together, it's not a single spike. But we have enough data, you can actually break it into small spatial bins, penetrating down to a 200 kilometer scale length rather than a 1,000 kilometer scale length, which is about the resolution of tomography, and do stacks on small scale. And then you get individual spikes here, 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 that were kind of all overlapping. We stacked over the 1,000 kilometer area. So there's enough data and enough fidelity of the data to be able to stack very locally. And image structure, it's kind of the lateral scale length that corresponds to the vertical scale length on the order of 200 kilometers. The red traces are models that fit this peak here, here, here. And you can see it varies in amplitude. And it varies in apparent depth significantly over a 1,000 kilometer patch, which is telling us there's either a lot of topography of this reflector or a lot of scattering structure in this reflector or something. Okay. Types of models you get from that involve fluctuations of a couple of percent of velocity below a pretty uniform depth reflector horizon. That's the type of thing that seismology can now do. You can also take data and image them not just as one-dimensional structure but over a a volume and do a scattering inversion in case this is really discrete lumps of material and try and image that. And that's the type of methods that's used in oil exploration that we call migration. It allows you at a given depth like this, 250 kilometers above the core, to find regions where energy reflects that may not be coming on the Great Circle, maybe scattering off out of the Great Circle plane. And with that, you can image the reflector. So this is a detailed model then of where the reflector is at various depths under the Cocos plate, and you can see it undulates. Now, we can't tell if it's laterally continuous, maybe blobs, and we're kind of averaging over that. But there's kind of some coherence spatially in how this reflector varies on a small scale that we've not penetrated to before. This is the first time I've been able to actually see this really robustly. That's what EarthScope's going to do, is allow us to do this over larger patches by a factor of 10 or so bigger, so we should be able to actually see the boundary layer fluctuations. Now I'll talk about that. And it's just a summary model, somewhat smooth, of the undulating topography of the boundary under particular assumptions for this migration model. I don't believe that topography is correct, but that's a long story. Well, that's what migration does. It puts material, or puts the phases out of plane. So if there's a 3D structure or scattering off of a blob sideways, you'll image it. Kinematically, you'll find where is the best place to produce the most coherent arrival. Now, I can be fooled. Migration's used to image the details of crustal salt domes and very complicated structures. It's the only way you can do it. Well, this is a limited migration because we don't have much azimuthal coverage. So, yeah, these models, I think this is the direction we can go, and EarthScope's going to expand the aperture and allow more crossing coverage. That'll be critical. Okay, I'm out of time, but I'm going to spend a little bit more time anyways, following yesterday's precedent. I'll finish by 10:15. I'll guarantee that. Okay, anisotropy under the Caribbean is also something you can model. And if you don't believe in anisotropy, I'll show you how easy it is to see anisotropy. Here is an S wave. This traces the SH, or the horizontally shearing part of the waveform. And this is the one that shears the ground up and down as the wave sweeps through the base of the mantle. And you can see the S waves here arriving on the two components. They lined up, nice little impulses. This is the reflection off of the top of D double prime. You can see that in both components as well. It's a little bit harder to interpret on the SV because the extra arrivals that arrive. And here is the reflection from the core for SH. And you should have the opposite polarity for SV. And you can see that they're not lined up. The S waves are lined up. We've corrected for the upper mantle lithospheric anisotropy. And you have several seconds of shift between these different polarizations of the S wave. So you can measure it. So it's there. And I don't think the seismologists are really arguing about the existence of it. We're now trying to map this out. And you see systematic shifts between this peak up and this trough down, a couple of seconds. Now, it's not to say I believe that all the anisotropy is well characterized in the rest of this waveform, but there is certainly a D double prime component to it. And it does have this tendency that in the circumpacific, the SVs will be later than the SHs, systematically. And I think Barbara and Panning did a study where they, on a global reconnaissance, find that's sort of the predominant pattern, where the SV polarization is later than the SH polarization. Kind of, if you had to pick a average model, you would have that. In detail, in the Caribbean, it's not right. I'm going to show you that. This is a result of a study. A lot of earthquakes in South America, stations across primarily Canada, good distances to be sampling D double prime in these darkened areas of the ray path. And this was kind of prompted by work that Kendall and Silver did a couple of years ago. And they're good seismologists. They looked at this waveform. Here's the SKS. It only shows up on the SV component, there's no tangential SKS, that's all as it should be. And they say, well, here's the SV and it's late by 2 seconds relative to the SH. And this peak and that peak are clearly shifted. And they measure that and they say, well, this is because of transverse isotropy, vertical transverse isotropy in D double prime. The problem is that it's wrong, and it's wrong because they're looking in a bandwidth that emphasizes the high frequency part of the ground motion. If you integrate this and look at ground displacement, you find that there is significant energy on the radial component at the same time as the arrival on the SH. And what this means is simply that as the waves split into a fast and a slow wave propagating through this medium, it wasn't purely polarized to be in the tangential and the vertical directions. It's at some angle to that, and that requires azimuthaline isotropy. It's not vertical transverse isotropy. And the amount of, so this arrival here is fast wave polarization projecting onto the SV and the SH component, followed by the slow wave that comes in, and it has projections on the SV and SH components. And so we're really misled by what looks like a nice clean observation, but you're looking at it in the wrong bandwidth. They're corrected for that. The SKS is clean up totally for it, but there's always ambiguity. Where I gain confidence is that we see this systematically over many stations, so it's hard to imagine that they're all the upper mantle corrections are equally bad so that you'll get this. It's not S to P conversions or anything else. So this has led us to revise our thinking about the symmetry. The conventional notion would be that you have something like vertical transverse isotropy would allow a clean decoupling of the SH and the SV wave field. We see that's not the case under the Caribbean, but it's very close to being the case. The SH is close to the fast wave. Okay, and so if you have a reconnaissance study, that would be a reasonable interpretation. But what you can do is you can change the symmetry. You could either depart from a simple hexagonal symmetry system, or you could explore changes in orientation. What we've done is change orientations so that we take a hexagonal system, and rather than have it vertical transverse isotropy, or what we call radial anisotropy, kind of characteristic of PREM is the upper mantle is radial anisotropy. And you tilt it, and if you tilt it a little bit from the vertical, here you just have a delayed SV relative to SH. As you tilt it, you get this energy, which is the fast wave leaking onto the other component. And you can predict data very well. You can't see it. You can predict it well and map out regions where the symmetry axis is tilting one direction or another. And so we're actually able now to get from detailed waveform modeling spatial variations in the orientation of the net fabric anisotropy of D double prime over scale lengths of about 1,000 kilometers. Now my hope is that this can feed into dynamical interpretations, just as anisotropy kind of guides interpretations of stress directions in the upper mantle, flow directions. At some point, as we improve this, and we're going to have gazillions more data with Earthscope right through this region, try and map out whether all these blues that are up here and these reds that are down here, and they kind of interfinger, but they probably are separate parts of the path that are causing this, can map out variations in azimuthal anisotropy, which is what Don showed yesterday. They've done so well for the upper mantle, you can associate with flow directions. Okay, so that concluded my stuff on this central Pacific area. It's got a high velocity in the tomographic models and in the regional model. Got a sharp discontinuity, it's anisotropic. I have much shorter presentations on these other areas. Under the central Pacific, big low velocity area in all the tomographic models, low velocity in D double prime. Some models show continuity of structure across the mantle, others don't really. But they agree that D double prime is very slow. Areas with which we find has strong heterogeneity. It does have a discontinuity, much to the chagrin of many. It has anisotropy. Some of the recent tomography suggests that there are structures under Hawaii that extend down deep into the mantle, but surprisingly, they peter out right in the source region. So maybe it's not well imaged. I think that's the case. However, People have argued maybe that's the end of the plume coming up.
Double plume.
Okay. This summarizes recent work Megan Avance has done with my students, mapping the top of the reflector in the middle of the Pacific, this reflection off the top of D double prime, and we see a clear reflection. I didn't expect to. It's a low velocity area, far removed from any downwelling slabs, and people like to make slabs account for attributes of the circumpacific. We see a reflector, but over 100 to 200 kilometer scale lengths has tremendous lateral variation in depth, on the order of 150 kilometers. And I think this is actually akin to the margin of one of these low velocity provinces that, on the large scale, has such steep sides. The colors here indicate strong reflections getting weaker and deeper as you move from southwest to northeast, going from this side to that side. And so the data allow us to map out reflectors in some detail. Under the southwest Pacific, also a slow velocity area in the tomography, right in the middle is where our waves turn, it's mostly red. And there's been some recent work at high resolution studying in particularly ultra-low velocities. I want to give an example of that because I think dynamically it's interesting. So this is modeling a very small patch of the Earth, vents in Tonga, looking at a small area recorded in a high-quality array in Australia. And what is seen is over just a degree of separation, looking at different elements of the seismic array, waveforms. This is an S wave that's gone down reflected from the core and come back as a P wave. And in the middle of this little azimuthal suite are these blue seismograms, which have a little bit of energy out here ahead of the main SCP phase. Now, if you take these guys, which only span about a half degree in distance, or in latitude, I'm sorry, is that? And maybe it's 2 degrees in azimuth. You stack them up, you find there's a nice little precursor to the SCP phase. Just outside that, these purple seismograms, you stack those up, they have nothing. So in a very small aperture, you see this reflection ahead of SCP, which is a topside reflection from the ULVZ. And the aspect or the attributes of the ULVZ estimated by these authors show it's a 10% P reduction, a 25% shear reduction, and a 10% increase in density. And it has to increase in density. You can't get the sign of this precursor right without that. So it's only about 50 kilometer wide blob. So I think Barbara's point earlier is very germane. The ULVZ can be in tiny patches and very localized, sub-Fresnel zone for the long wavelength studies, but very, very strong. And these authors, Rose, Garnero, Williams, Manga, has submitted a paper arguing that this is a little patch of at the root of a plume. 10% dense, at least. Could live with more.
It's not light, not buoyant.
The low velocity zone is believed to be the residue of iron-enriched material underneath their upwelling in their model. So you get part of the shear velocity reduction from the iron enrichment, the density increase from the iron enrichment, but it's a thermal anomaly which is driving the overall velocities. It's partially molten. Okay, so under the Pacific area, we do have a sharp velocity increase at the top, though it's got steep sides, steep topography. We've got ULVZ. I mentioned at the very beginning that there's large-scale low velocity. I won't talk about anisotropy in this region, though it's complicated. Okay, just a few more minutes. Under the Central Atlantic, very quickly, similar state, but the Central Atlantic's interesting because it's not in the circumpacific high-velocity region nor in the African low velocity. It's in the transition. So all of the models go from fast to slow across this, but right in the middle, you're kind of average velocities. And so we were interested in this region, studied it with lots of data from South American earthquakes recorded in Asia. And indeed, the travel time anomalies show gradient from earlier in the Western Atlantic to later in the Eastern Atlantic. But in between, there's not much anomaly. And this shows that there's almost no shear wave splitting occurring. And Barbara's model also shows patterns of regions where you have SH fast, SV fast, and then there are regions where there isn't any splitting. And on the local scale, this confirms that. And I think it's intriguing that if you're going to have a ubiquitous kind of phase change that's anisotropic or something, there are regions where, at least with these waves and their polarizations, which are for different earthquakes, various polarizations, you don't have shear wave splitting. So my final regional study would be this big South African plume. And this is work from Nee and Helmberger. Here's a cross sections through the mantle and tomographic models. I guess this is Ritzema's model. And you see it's all kind of yellow or red. That means it's slightly slow or very slow velocities. And the biggest slow velocity region is in the base of the mantle. This is 2,900 kilometers deep. Now, the argument is that, well, the tomography is smooth. Adam showed you can't really reproduce the actual amplitudes because of the damping of tomography. So they argue, well, in fact, this structure is much stronger and extends up continuously 1,000 kilometers, but they're kind of guided by the tomography as to where the anomaly may be. And they model it in detail and demonstrate convincingly that it has to have lateral edges by experiments like this. We have earthquakes that sweep along the margins of this. So some of the waveforms are in the low velocity material, some are outside of it before they're observed. And this type of strong lateral gradient across the suite of data, this may be hard to see. If you plot it as a function of distance, you get a chaotic pattern. If you plot it as a function of azimuth, you get very nice systematic arrivals, which I think is what Barbara was alluding to. So it's kind of, it's much more organized azimuthally as a fan shoot as in the seismic parlance than it is just as a radial profile. So these strong azimuthal gradients are there. And the occurrence of two bumps here corresponds to one wave going through the slow stuff, one wave going through the fast stuff. And you can model that with 3D synthetic methods like SEM, like extended ray theory that Helmberger's used. And you find for these ultra-low velocity superplume provinces, indeed, they're low velocity, averaging 3 to 5% low, possibly extending up 1,000 kilometers. The margin, these areas don't have P velocity. I won't have time to show that. Don't have any P velocity anomaly of significance. And they have very steep sides. They're bounded by regions with no velocity anomaly and no anisotropy. Okay, so summary for coffee. A lot of structural, what seismic imaging can provide, structural complexity. And we infer that there's a lot of dynamic complexity associated with these structures. But that's for you all to tell me what's going on. The specifics, there's heterogeneity, strong at short scale lengths of 50 to 100 kilometers. We're able to now penetrate down to those scale lengths. It's getting more interesting seismically. The smaller we're able to resolve structure, the more complex it is. So it's like the geochemists. I'm not yet ready to quit because I think it's still got organization to it, but there is this kind of concern that even these are strongly kind of spatially aliased images of what's really there. And I think what's really there is geology. It's magmatic processes. It's as complicated as what we have at the surface of the Earth, mitigated by some factors, the high pressures, the high densities, or PT conditions, inhibiting some of the complexity that we have at the surface. We probably have a lot of volatiles running around, for example. But on the other hand, I think we're still seeing heavily smooth images of fine scale heterogeneity and processes that might mislead us still. I think there's that real serious caveat to put on all the seismic modeling. But it's rewarding enough that I think we're still making progress. We haven't flattened out in what we're learning, because these results, everything I showed you has been done in the last 6 months. I mean, we can do this increasingly quickly now. The discontinuity, it's highly variable, has topography on large and small scales. Particularly, it exists under the Central Pacific, far away from slabs, so if you want to make that discontinuity by the same mechanism in the Circumpacific and the Central Pacific, you're probably going to appeal to something like a phase change or a chemically contiguous layer across D double prime. There's good increasing evidence for azimuthal anisotropy in large regions, and it's close to VTI, but not VTI, and that might help us test mechanisms as to whether this is MGO or perovskite or post-perovskite LPO, lattice preferred orientation alignment of crystals, or whether it's a structural effect of kind of anastomosing type structures in a sheared boundary layer that can give you a fabric anisotropy rather than a crystalline anisotropy. And ultra-low velocity zones can be extremely localized down to the scale length of 50 kilometers, which is something that Helmberg has said for some time, and I wasn't convinced of it because the data were still long period and subject to other interpretations, but this short period data from array processing is really convincing that that stuff can be very localized and very, very strong. So there's got to be some process that can produce over 100 kilometer scale lengths or less 10, 30% changes in velocity and 10% changes in density. Okay. So I'm going to skip next steps because the next step is coffee. And I'll end it with what's happening in D double prime. Okay, thank you.
This is going up and down instead of.
I learned a good dynamic term last night at dinner. It's sloshing. Those are sloshing blobs. I don't know. This is blame this on Garnero.
There's a body of work you didn't talk much about, which is scattering at the scale of the seismic wavelength. Do you want to say anything about that? Is that convincing?
Well, the problem, I think, is that there's sort of conflicting results from the seismic community. There's the Peter Shearer work, which uses kind of fluctuations in times from ISC picks and plus augmented by some waveform picks, that suggests that scatterers to PKP or some of the other classic methodologies for determining scattering in D double prime, that the scatterers are no stronger in D double prime than they are anywhere else in the lower mantle. Kind of a uniform scattering. Very weak, depending on models. Kuznetsov got very weak estimates of the scattering strengths, but you can live with a fraction of a percent at 10 kilometer scale lengths. So you don't need much. But you juxtapose that with localized studies where there is very, very strong scattering in what appears to be attributable to the ULVZ, where you have 10 and 20% density fluctuations. No problem to scatter very strongly short periods. So either the global average composite that Shearer talks about has washed out those effects, or there's kind of, he's overzealous in interpreting kind of the average models. So I think there's strong scattering right at the core mantle boundary in some patches. That's been pretty convincingly modeled by Wen and Helmberger and others that show that you put little blobs of 10% anomalies and you get scattering that matches the strongest scattering observations. So making a general conclusion about whether scattering is stronger in D double prime or not, I don't think we yet have an answer. With the heterogeneity in the existing models, this kind of fine scale stuff of ULVZs can certainly do it. It can, you know, quantitatively can count for a lot of scattering. There's a lot more room for it to be pursued, but really to do scattering well, you'd like to have the situation we had in the 60s, a huge ray like LASSA. Then you can actually see the out-of-plane behavior, and you can separate scattering upon entry and upon exit from the core phases, things that you could do with a big aperture ray. We can't do now unless we get clever in using something like Terrascope, which will be spatially aliased at the surface, but maybe we can use it to do some new scattering approaches.
But is the big picture clearer? In general, USRA will help.
Well, that's the hope, though, you know, with the 70 kilometer spacing. You're talking about what used to have within LASA 25 or 30 stations. So I don't think we're going to get near as good a result as LASA. John Bedali has made efforts to go and retrieve LASA data, and that led to his arguments for scattering from the inner core. It's very powerful to have these huge numbers of stations, but that's something that seismologists haven't been able to afford for decades. Scattering from absorption? Well, this is waveform complexity scattering. So you're actually seeing dispersion of the energy over some interval, and you can kinematically figure out where in the Earth it could have traveled to. Absorption is going to just knock down high frequencies. So you know, it's not the same problem as when you see an attenuated phase, it's hard to tell if that's scattering losses or intrinsic attenuation losses. It's not that problem. Here you've got, you know, complexity of the waveform that absorption can't produce. I mean, heterogeneity in Q can play a role, but it's mostly going to be structural heterogeneity that sets up little reflection and conversion gradients that give you these complex extra arrivals. Coffee?